Law is Cool, episode number 10.
Hello and welcome to episode 10 of the Law is Cool podcast. My name is Thomas Wisdom, a second-year law student at Osgoode Hall Law School, and we also have Omar Haredi. And today we'll be featuring interviews with David Ilward and the Honorable Christopher Bentley, the Attorney General of Ontario.
That's correct. But before we get to that, maybe we can talk about a little bit about that transition from being that first year to the second year law student.
Very interesting transition.
Has it sunk in yet for you? I mean, do you actually feel like you're, you know, a second-year law student now?
Oh, no, not at all. No.
It is sort of a sense of accomplishment, definitely.
Absolutely. And when you get those final grades back, and you didn't do as bad as you thought you were going to do, you know, because you thought you were going to fail and drop out, and your parents were going to stop loving you, and you're going to live in a cardboard box for the rest of your life, and have illegitimate children all over the city, and become an alcoholic and a drug abuser, and it's terrible. None of it's going to happen.
I don't know if you caught one of the recent posts on Law is Cool about a seven-year law degree.
Seven-year law degree? I didn't even know that was possible. I thought they were strict with their long-term study plans.
Well, this was actually an article by Jordan Furlong, who said that the way law students should look at it is as if it's a seven-year law degree.
Okay.
So after you do your 3 years, you do your 1 year of articling, it usually takes about 3 years of practice until you get a good handle on the law.
Yeah.
And those first 3 years are usually pretty intensive. There are a lot of work as well, and there's incredible burnout and turnover as well during those years. So I think if you go into this with the attitude that it's a seven-year law degree, might be a little bit easier to get a handle on this.
It's actually a very healthy way of looking at it, and now I'm reconsidering my legal career. 7 more years. Are you kidding me? Obviously, we learn a lot of very important stuff at school, but there's only so much they can teach.
Yeah.
And I think that, and I'm sure most people would agree, I mean, most of the substantive learning you do is
in the office.
I think most of the learning is going to happen there. Important 3 years.
There you go.
Thank you for the enlightenment. I'll prepare myself.
But, Thomas, I noticed that your voice is a little bit different now. Could that be because of this new habit that you picked up?
You know, little smoking habit. It's not something.
How did that happen?
Well, it's not something that intelligent people start at a late age. Generally, you start smoking when you're a little kid.
And then or a teenager.
And you become addicted and you just stay stupid, right? I became stupid enough to smoke at some point during law school. It was a week before finals.
Okay?
I'm preparing a trip. And this is a bad time to prepare a trip because you've got the anxiety of studying plus the anxiety of spending money you don't have on a trip and booking apartments and flights and all kinds of nonsense, right? But I ended up asking classmates, you know, what do you do for relief of stress relief? How do you make yourself feel better? Some people have breathing exercises, some people meditate, go for walks, eat junk food.
Some people smoke.
One dude smokes. You know, he said, hey, Tom, why don't you try smoking?
Okay.
Give it a shot. So, like an idiot, I tried smoking. It was beautiful. It was a magical experience. It's like a very cheap way of meditating, you know, because you get a good place to sit. It's very quiet. You have your own little breathing exercise. It's not necessarily healthy, of course. Not as healthy as meditation, obviously. But, you know, everybody has their own therapy, right? So I decided that whenever I was feeling particularly stressed out, have a cigarette. Exams were over in 20 days. I'd be done smoking. And I was. I hadn't become addicted. It's fine. So,
but then you went on this trip, right?
Then I went on a trip. Went on a legal law student exchange program to Florence, Italy.
Okay. And what was that like?
Well, everybody smokes in Florence. You know, so the environment was right.
Okay.
So I kept smoking, and now it's like a...
Went in Florence to as the...
Florentine. Yeah, that's my legacy from my first year of law school, is a deadly, stupid habit.
So if by second year doing, you become an alcoholic, and by third year a crack addict.
By third year, hopefully the heroin.
The heroin, okay. Yeah. So maybe by the time you do your bars and your articles, you might actually get that cardboard box after all.
Maybe.
Well, if you ever do want to get out of the, if the stress ever does get too much, I think that's one of the things David Aylward's going to talk to us about, is how he transitioned from a legal career, where he was working in a firm, doing some legal work, went into politics, and then actually, and is now doing some interesting work in coordinating efforts between the private sector and the public sector, specifically with the military agencies. So let's listen to some of the advice that he gives on how to get out of law for those people who are looking for a change in their legal career.
My name is David Aylward. I went to college at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, got a bachelor's of arts, went into politics for 2 years, and then went to law school in Washington, D.C. at George Washington University, and 3 years later got a law degree.
Mm-hmm.
For a law firm to pay my way through school, as a law clerk in procurement, federal procurement law, and then was hired as an associate attorney for a year after that, and then went to work in the U.S. Congress for 3.5 years on the personal staff of a congressman focused on communications issues. And then became the chief counsel and staff director of the U.S. House of Representatives Subcommittee on Telecommunications, Consumer Protection, and Finance when my boss became the chairman of it, and did that for 4 years.
And maybe you can describe for us how your legal background helped you in those capacities.
There was nothing in particular in law school that trained me for any of this. In terms of subject matter, but certainly the discipline of the legal education and writing and thought process and the focus on the meaning of words and that each word means something and stringing them together means something more was a great lesson I learned and applied in the future. And when I left the U.S. House of Representatives in 1985, I established a consulting practice in Washington, D.C., where I did not practice law, but provided strategic public policy and business consulting to various private and NGO clients. And then about 10 years ago, founded a not-for-profit, the purpose of which is to improve emergency response. And that is a membership organization, doesn't sell any products. It's an educational group that is supported by dues, contracts, and grants.
Given your background in both the private sector and politics, I understand that you have an interest in promoting interoperability between civilian and military agencies. Maybe you can explain a little bit more about that as it relates to complex humanitarian disasters.
In responding to any form of emergency, whether it's car crash or a heart attack or a complex human disaster, there is traditionally been done via voice communications. And the different entities that are participating communicate by telephone, fax, or radio. That is an extraordinarily inefficient way to respond to any sort of event, one with a huge amount of parties involved and therefore a huge amount of information. What you want to have is an interoperable system that allows the communication of voice data and video amongst all the relevant parties. And we do not have that ability in the United States, and we don't have that ability internationally today. So there really needs to be a major focus on how you bridge the gaps between what have traditionally been entirely separate, independent professions, police, fire, EMS, hospitals, public health, and so on, and need to be interoperable data sharing organizations.
Okay. And do you ever see, for example, public agencies looking at the communication operability of the private sector, for example, or the commercial sector, and saying, you know, why can't I have that, or why can't we do what they do, and any of that type of attitude?
That's a great question, and the answer is not enough. I mean,
okay.
You would think that folks would be banging themselves in the head and saying, why am I paying $4,000 for a radio that doesn't take mm-hmm. pictures when I can get one for $100 that takes pictures? Why am I paying $4,000 for a radio that cannot communicate with somebody else's radio when my Samsung phone can talk to an LG phone, can talk to, a Motorola phone?
Mm-hmm.
It's commercial. And the answer is that one of the big problems of emergency responders is they're not really aware of what they don't have or what they could have.
Okay.
So part of the problem here is an education that needs to be done on what is technically and operationally possible.
And I guess that would also apply to, like, intelligence and information sharing as well between agencies and the private sector and the public sector as well?
Yeah, yes, it would. There's not a whole lot of difference technically between intelligence sharing and emergency response information sharing. Other than the higher need for security on intelligence sharing. But there is, on the intelligence side, a higher degree of cultural resistance to sharing information, much more of a need to know versus a need to share mentality. But technically, you have the same problems. People need to use standards. You need to have services that would identify who the parties are and what their mm-hmm. rights are. And you have the same cultural problems of people owning their own systems and not wanting to share.
And what advice would you give to law students who were interested in doing the unorthodox or non-traditional type of career, and how to make that transition from working in a law firm as you did into those areas?
I think the most important one is more psychological advice than it is career advice, but it ends up being career advice, and that is that throughout my 30-year-something career, I keep running into people who hate their jobs and say, I feel trapped. And I say, well, what would you like to do? And they say, well, I'd like to do this or that or the other thing. And I say, well, why don't you do it? And they say, well, gee, I think I might fail. I might not be able to make enough money doing it. And so people end up, lawyers are classics of this, working in areas that they don't like, for clients mm-hmm. they don't respect, for reasons of somebody else making decisions for them. The neat thing about a law degree is that it is the single professional qualification that basically is a license to hunt, to do just about anything you want to do.
Uh-huh.
And so I have very little patience for lawyers who tell me that they feel trapped. I spent a lot of time in the late 80s and early 90s doing finance work, having mm-hmm. nothing to do with communications. Helping employees be involved in acquisitions. And then that period was over and you adjust to something different. But the neat thing about a legal degree is it trains you non-specifically in tools that are useful in lots of different fields. And I was never trained in information technology. I'm having a great deal of fun learning it and applying the legal training I have to how to apply information technology in an emergency response environment. There are issues that come up all the time that have to do with law, like privacy rights and liability rights and things that are very familiar to me because I'm trained as a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
but the essence of it, of what I'm doing, isn't law. So that's how one lawyer works. But the major point is there are lots and lots of opportunities in North America, whether it's Canada, the United States, and Mexico, to pursue things that are of interest. And I would hate to see people feeling like they don't have choices. Anybody who has a law degree has lots of choices.
Well, great. That's refreshing for all of us to hear, I'm sure.
All right. Thank you, Omar. Take care.
The legal profession is not a death sentence.
Not by any means.
If you're not happy, you're free to leave. And it's a lot more constructive to put your legal degree and legal experience to use elsewhere rather than sit around and complain.
I agree.
Think we can both agree with that. So this would be a good moment, you know, considering the little diatribe about cigarettes just now, to mention that neither Omar nor myself actually want to leave the legal profession, nor are we chronic complainers. We're both very happy doing what we're doing. And it's like a love-hate thing, you know? Like,
yeah.
I love the student lifestyle, and I love the learning. I love the actual material. And I've had a lot of good luck with getting some really awesome professors, like think-outside-the-box type professors, you know? So I don't know, man. I could actually do a law degree for 7 years if I had to. But 3 years is good.
Good
three
for you.
3 years is good, but I could last longer if I had to.
Now, well, one of the things you were mentioning, when you were in Florence, you noticed there was a considerable delay in terms of judicial process there. Is that correct?
Apparently, it's quite common in the Italian legal system for your average tort case to last about 10 years.
Wow.
Just because of various layers of inefficiency in the system. So,
well, we're not nearly that bad here in Canada, but there are some reforms that are being made here in the province of Ontario to definitely speed up trials, specifically for the criminal law system.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be speaking with the Attorney General, who's going to shed some light on that. Mm. Interestingly enough, Minister Bentley is from London, Ontario, so I am in the same city as him, and he was kind enough to speak to us for this interview.
Cool. So let's hear what he has to say on that topic.
I'm Chris Bentley, the MPP for London West and the Attorney General for the Province of Ontario.
Now, Minister Bentley, as I understand it, you used to actually teach in my law school, is that correct?
Well, that's right. I had a full-time law practice, most of which was criminal law, a little bit of labor law. And after practicing for about 10 years, I started practicing part-time teaching at the University of Western Ontario Law School. Now, that was very part-time. Started in the evening with a first-year criminal law class, and it moved on from there.
Okay. And your experiences as an instructor in criminal law, how is that?
Well, you know, teaching was great. It was a great part of what I did. It was entirely different from the practice of law. You know, law students are have a lot of different questions, interesting perspective, very optimistic about the future, haven't been jaded at all by life's experience. So it was a very energizing experience. I was able to bring my experiences from the practice of law into the classroom, and the students were able to bring their experiences from different aspects of their life and challenge or ask about the law in a way that I wouldn't otherwise have it asked about in terms of practice.
Now, being involved in the criminal justice system, did that in any way raise any issues or concerns in terms of access to justice in your role as Attorney General?
Well, you know, in practicing criminal law and on the defense side, the issue of access to justice is a huge issue. You know, one of the things that brought me into the practice of law and one of the things that interested me about public life from the beginning was a determination to make sure that people who wouldn't otherwise have a voice got a voice, people who wouldn't otherwise have access to legal representation got it, people who hadn't enjoyed the opportunities that our society and life presents would begin to enjoy those opportunities.
Okay.
And the practice of criminal law enabled me to do that to some extent, and I moved from there, of course, into public life to do it to a greater extent.
Okay. And as I understand it, your office recently has launched a new program to address these issues.
Well, we've launched several different programs, and one of them is the Justice on Target initiative with respect to making the criminal courts work faster. Now, you say, how does making the criminal courts work faster really affect access to justice? The fact of the matter is that the rights that are protected by the Charter, the rights that are protected in our laws, rights that are for the accused, for witnesses, for victims, complainants, for citizens generally, are not advanced with a justice system that slows down. And the initiative in our criminal courts is to speed up the process, reduce unnecessary appearances, so that we can redirect the resources that are spent on those unnecessary appearances to the more important parts of the justice system, and we can help better secure the rights outlined in the Charter and other statutes.
Okay. And as I understand it, London was actually one of the test sites where you were trying out this program?
Well, London is one of the areas that we launched or had the announcement of this. Mm-hmm. London has been a leader in a number of different respects. It's long been looked at throughout the province as a jurisdiction that has worked better than the others, than some of the others. And so London has some lessons to teach.
Okay.
We've also launched in our London courts something called legal aid in the courthouse, which means that those who need to apply for legal assistance can actually do so in the courthouse as opposed to having to go to the legal aid office. And we'll also be piloting an enhanced, streamlined legal aid application so that they'll be able to get their answer faster. All of this means that you can retain your lawyer faster if you know you're going to be supported by legal aid, assuming you have very little finances to do so on your own. And it speeds up the justice process in the course of it.
Okay. And in terms of speeding up processes as well, I believe also your office has taken on some of the delays in the human rights system as well, right?
You know, we have a good human rights system that's evolved over the years. Parties of all stripes have looked for opportunities to strengthen it. One of the challenges that we've had, though, over the course of at least 15 years, is that our human rights system has slowed down.
Mm-hmm.
People who have a complaint can't get a hearing for years. And that's not good for the complainant, it's not good for the respondent, and it's not good for upholding the human rights outlined in the code and other statutes. So what we've done is to take advice that's been given to governments for over 15 years. We've revamped the human rights system. We've given people direct access to it, direct access to the hearings tribunal for the first time. And we've also set up, again for the first time, an independent legal support center to ensure that there is legal support for all complainants from the beginning of the process. Very exciting. It's going to greatly strengthen the advancement of human rights in this province, and it all begins on June 30th.
And why are human rights so important? Why, from your perspective?
Well, you know, everybody in society should have the opportunity to live their life and achieve their potential without artificial barriers being put up, barriers that bear no relation to the foundations of our society. We have a society of optimism, of opportunity, and we have long taken the position that people should be able to live their lives without discrimination, without barriers being put up, whether they be race, religion, culture, heritage, sexual orientation, or other. This human rights system revamp will ensure that those rights that we take for granted, that we want to support and strengthen, will in fact be achieved. Because again, delaying hearings, delaying the cases involving human rights does not advance those human rights.
Okay. Well, definitely does sound exciting, and we look forward to all these changes happening.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Efficiency and law don't seem to be compatible, but no reason not to keep trying, obviously, right? And, of course, the importance of an efficient legal system, I mean, come on, especially something like criminal justice. Let's say you're talking about a false accusation.
Uh-huh.
Nothing huge, like a Donald Marshall, like that, but something closer to home, something like that the average Joe might get stuck with just
yep.
because he did something stupid in a bad social situation.
Okay? People want resolution.
They want resolution.
Exactly.
And a criminal trial or the preparation for a criminal trial could take more than a year, longer, and you're talking about the individual, the families, everybody going through hell, money being spent, most cases money that people don't have. You know, it's a mental and emotional drain. You know?
Definitely.
So
I think these measures are great measures.
Absolutely, they certainly are. And no matter how hard it has been and will be, it's, you know, you've got to have people constantly spearheading, you know, initiatives for improving the efficiency of human rights tribunals, criminal justice systems, tort law in Canada or Italy or wherever, everywhere. This stuff's just, it's generally not very pleasant, and it should be taken care of as quickly as possible.
Definitely. I think that's it for this episode of Law School. Thanks for listening.